Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, two of Britain's best-known fund managers had a year to forget in 2025. So is it time to ditch the star stock pickers, or are they about to be proved right? Also today, will the Chancellor's cash ISA limit cut get us investing? Not even MPs are convinced. Is it time to make another U-turn? Plus, we look at the quiet London house price crash, ask if cashback is worth it, and tell you the best to use electric cars for less than 10 grand. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. Do you love talking about money as much as you love listening to it? Then you'll enjoy this. Charles Stanley Direct's financial coaching service gives you a real human, yes, an actual expert, to help you make sense of your finances. No jargon, no pressure, just clear answers to your money questions. Book a free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, your future self will thank you. Remember, investment involves risk. Now back to the show. It's been a rough old 2025 for two of Britain's best-known fund managers. Terry Smith's Fundsmith returned just 0.8% for investors, while Nick Train's Finsbury Growth and Income Trust lost its investors 6%. As the debate rages over active versus passive, it would have proved a better move for investors to ditch the fund managers for cheap index tracker funds, simply backing the market. And we know someone who holds both Fundsmith and Finsbury Growth in their portfolio. So what will he do next? Simon, as the only male in the room here, I'm suspecting that he is you.
It is me.
Firstly, what do fund managers do?
Fund managers manage a pool of money that has been put forward by investors. Then they take that money and they try to buy assets that they believe will deliver good performance for a reasonable level of risk, and also in line with what that stated fund's aims are. You could have, for example, the This Is Money highly exciting fund managed by yours truly, Simon Lambert, and my aim is to go out and find the most exciting companies in the world and pick them and try to deliver a return that beats the market. Or you might also have the This Is Money really boring but safe fund, managed again by Simon Lambert, who has donned his sensible shoes and decided to invest in assets that will deliver a reliable return, taking less risk and getting less volatility. Fortunately, yours truly is not actually a fund manager, and there are much better qualified professionals who actually do the job. And you have managers who manage what are known as open-ended funds, which are traditionally called investment funds. Basically, they're the biggest part of the investment fund unit universe. And you also have managers who manage something called investment trusts, which are basically an investment fund that is itself listed on the stock exchange. So when you buy into an investment trust, you buy its shares and you sell its shares, and there's a limited number of shares. So that investment trust could at any given time have a share price that is worth more than the assets that it holds, so it's at a premium, or could be, if people don't like it, worth less than the assets that it holds, so it's at a discount. Whereas the open-ended funds, the investment funds, they always trade at the level pretty much of the assets that they hold. And if there's a sudden rush of investors to put their money in, then the fund manager has to go out and buy more investments. And if there's a sudden rush of investors to take their money out, then the fund manager has to sell some investments in order to fund those redemptions.
So in that regard, then, when we talk about active versus passive, what debate are we talking about here?
We're talking about the debate as to whether you should employ a fund manager to try and pick the best investments for you. And we're going to talk mainly about picking shares here, because both Nick Train and Terry Smith are fund managers whose funds are equity funds, so they hold shares. Mm-hmm. But you can also have fund managers who buy bonds. You can have fund managers who buy other assets, gold, property, pretty much anything. The debate is whether you should have that fund manager trying to choose the best investments, or whether you should adopt a passive approach. And a passive approach is basically to just follow the market. And there will be a chosen market. So you'll choose something that's either called a tracker fund or an ETF, and it will follow a set index. And that is a basket of investments. And the idea is that it will track it as closely as possible. You do get some tracking error. You get some that are fall further away from the actual performance of the index. And then you also have to look at the fees, because that will eat into it as well. But the fees on passive investments tend to be much lower. And the argument for passive investing is that you are simply allowing the market to do its work, and that's what you're relying on. And that by not trying to pick winners, which is what a fund manager does, you also don't run the risk of picking losers, which is also what a lot of fund managers do. And there is a great deal of research out there that shows how incredibly difficult it is for fund managers to consistently beat the market over the long term, but also that we probably assess them over two short periods, and that in order to assess whether a fund manager can actually consistently beat the market, are they genuinely delivering added value to their investors, you need to measure it over a really long period of time.
Like 20 years?
Yeah, like something like that rather than five.
Right. So what
you're
saying
more than one.
Is essentially the cheaper, much simpler option is making you more money than some of these superstar stock pickers, fund managers. So the question obviously inevitably would be, do you ditch it? But before we get to there, Terry Smith and Nick Train, I'm sure our listeners will have heard their names before, but they really are quite big deals, aren't they?
Yeah, they are very big deals. Essentially, they are Britain's two biggest star fund managers at the moment. The thing about the fund management industry, especially the active fund management industry, is it appeals to our love of the story. Now, you will get many fans of passive investing who say, why don't you write more about tracker funds? And we do write about tracker funds. We write about tracker funds all the time. But have you ever tried interviewing a tracker fund? It's really boring. What are you buying?
Touché.
Everything. What do you hold? Everything. What do you like? Everything. They are inanimate objects. Whereas, for example, by comparison, Terry Smith includes in his letter to shareholders the absolute gem of one of our mantras has been that we should always invest in businesses which could be run by an idiot, so the performance is not heavily reliant upon management. We have been made painfully aware that the range of businesses which can be run by an idiot is much more limited than we thought.
Wow.
I mean, maybe in the world of generative AI, we're going to start getting quotes like that from tracker funds. But as it stands, fund managers equal stories. People like to read stories. And there is the cult of the star fund manager. Now, rightly or wrongly, there is the cult of the star fund manager. Some of them fall down to earth with a bang. Neil Woodford, for example, whose fund arguably was not really doing what it was meant to be doing or what many of his investors thought it should be doing, and blew up quite spectacularly.
But let's be clear, that's not what is going on here with Terry Smith and Nick Train.
In contrast, Terry Smith and Nick Train are very clear on what they do. They are very clear on their investment approach, and they are following it. And for many years, that was a very, very successful investment approach. And if you look at the long term, both Smith and Train have excellent records of beating the market. But if you look over the past 5 years, neither of them has managed to beat the market once. So by holding their funds, you have lost out. There's an opportunity cost. You could have just held the market and you would have made more money. You'd be richer. Now, in some years, that gap wasn't massive, but in other years, it was pretty big. And last year, I think we reached the zenith of this underperformance, where, as you said, Terry Smith delivered just 0.8%. And Finsbury Gofen Income lost its investors' money. Unfortunately, it lost them 6%. So not only would you have been better off in a tracker fund, you'd have actually been better off in a savings account.
Ooh.
Question is, if you're an investor like me who holds one of these funds or both of these funds, what should you do now?
I mean, look, firstly, was this just because the stock market's had a Della rise, AI, all that sort of thing, that it's actually quite difficult to beat it? Is there an element of that?
Yeah. There is a real problem for active fund managers at the moment. And the problem for active fund managers is that the stock market is going up by so much. And the stock market, it's the biggest problem is for global fund managers who invest all around the world, because the problem is the global stock market. And this is a nice problem to have if you are a passive investor and you've been holding a global stock market tracker, because your investments will have gone up by lots. But the global stock market is dominated by the US stock market currently because of the big, big gains we've seen there. It's now more than 70% of the global stock market. And of that 70%, the US market is dominated by a small number of very large US tech firms, the Magnificent Seven, who have seen their share prices rise by colossal amounts in recent years. Nvidia, the world's largest company, is a classic example of this. It's worth more than the UK stock market. And it means that it's very, very concentrated. And what that means is that if you are a fund manager and you don't hold those stocks, then you are going to fall behind the market unless you've found some other spectacularly good investments. Now, there are some fund managers who have managed to comfortably beat the market and found some other spectacularly good investments. Some of them have gone looking for what is termed value investing stocks, for example, which is companies that where their value has been beaten up by so much that they then see a change in sentiment and a big rise in the value. Others have gone for different types of growth stocks. Others have invested in different parts of the world. The problem that Terry Smith and Nick Train have is that they invest in what are generally seen as quality companies. And these are large, reliable companies with robust balance sheets, businesses that should work through thick and thin, year in, year out, and should just keep delivering profits for investors. And at one point, these types of company were very, very popular indeed. Hugely popular after the financial crisis when interest rates were on the floor, government bonds yielded almost nothing or in some cases negative amounts, in which case to an institutional investor, to a big investor, a big, stable, global company paying a 3% dividend looked very attractive indeed. To an individual investor, it looked very attractive indeed compared to a savings account that paid them less than 0.5%. Now, turn the world on its head, with the ultra profits of the US tech giants, the COVID lockdown, then the inflation spike, and then most importantly, interest rates rising. And all of a sudden, those companies don't look so attractive because you can get 4% from a government bond, which is pretty safe. So why would you invest in one of these for the dividend alone? And the share price has fallen as the demand has fallen for them. So you're not getting the share price gains because there's less demand for the income that they pay out. There's also just less demand for their businesses as a whole because just the general investor sentiment has changed and everybody's just looking over here at those big US tech stocks that are making super duper profits. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, like, okay, I like a pint of Guinness, but like, what do I want to own Diageo for when I could own Nvidia? And so they're caught in a perfect storm, effectively. Now, both Nick Train and Terry Smith, as I said, have very similar investing styles, and they are referred to as Buffett-style investors. But Warren Buffett, the world's most famous investor, isn't a fund manager. He's a businessman. And quite a lot of his success has come from striking the kind of deals that ordinary investors and even fund managers cannot strike. If you were a fund manager and you want to buy shares in a company, for most funds, there are some that you don't have to do this. For most funds, you're going to have to go buy those shares on the market, pretty much paying what the market is charging for the shares. If you're Warren Buffett, you don't have to do that. You just speak to the company direct and say, I'd like to take a stake in you. You can negotiate preferential terms. If it's in the aftermath of the financial crisis, when there's lots of companies that are suffering massively, you can negotiate very favorable terms, and then you can make a lot of money off it. And if you do those things over a very long period of time, as Warren Buffett has, and you use the cash pile from your business and the money generated elsewhere here to do this and then to do that, then you can genuinely create a style of investing that beats the market. But it's actually a lot more buccaneering than is given credit for. And also, interestingly, Warren Buffett, he says you should buy a tracker fund.
So Simon, the question is, and you posed it earlier, what will you do?
Well, as I said in my column, should I just say thanks for the memories and the good returns and ditch them?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's quite tempting, okay? Because if I look at what I've made long term, I've held both of these since 2012. Now, Fundsmith has delivered the better return out of the two. invest in the global market. The global market has delivered a better return. Finsbury Growth and Income invests in the UK. My Fundsmith investment, it's difficult to tell because over the years I've changed investment platforms. So when I've done that, the cost that I bought for hasn't been properly carried over. I've also added to investments. With Fundsmith, it's a bit clearer because I've only added to the investment twice and I've got what's known as the accumulation fund. So all the dividends are rolled up within the fund. So you see a genuine total return. With that, I think I've made about a 226% return, which is great. It has turned £1,650 into like £5,000. That's pretty good. But most of those returns came quite some time ago. Finsbury Growth and Income, it's harder to tell. I do know from Googling an old column that I initially bought the shares at 350p and they're now at something like 800 and something p. So I've comfortably more than doubled my money. I think I worked out 137% return on that. But then I've added chunks of money at different times after that and reinvested dividends. And it pays out a reasonable dividend. So that kind of adds up over the time. And I think some rough kind of back of an envelope maths, basically apart from that initial investment, the rest of the money I've put in has gone pretty much nowhere. At one point I would have been up substantially, but because things have come off the boil, I'm not. So what I should really be doing is saying, okay, this money, if I put this money somewhere else, does it have a better opportunity of making money? So two choices. Should I just put it in a tracker fund? Potentially, yes. Mm-hmm. But what I talked about earlier with this over-dependence on the US tech giants, these fears over the AI bubble and things like that, I'm a bit dubious about that. Also, this is in my investment ISA, right, where it's a lot more spread around lots of active funds and things like this, that my pension, on the other hand, my work pension, is largely invested just in a global tracker. So I'm thinking, okay, well, most of my money's doing that. I can do some stuff with the other money. Should I invest it in another active fund or just something completely different? Maybe, if I think there's a better opportunity there. But also what I'm aware of is that what I shouldn't be doing is making a decision based on what's happened over the last 5 years. Because whilst past performance is no guarantee of future gains, so the first, you know, 7 years or however long it is, I can't remember what I'm talking about, of holding these where I had the good returns, I shouldn't rely on that to just make me think that returns are going to be good. But I also shouldn't rely on the last 5 years to just make me think the returns are going to be bad. Mm-hmm. And there is a possibility that as we see this shift away from giant US tech companies, and we are seeing this, you know, they're still going up quite a lot. There's still a lot of demand behind them, but we're seeing just a bit of money shift away. And you only need a little bit of money to shift away from them because they're so big that only a little bit of money would make quite a big difference elsewhere. If that shifts away, there's a chance it might shift into the type of companies that Smith and Train hold. And if the market takes a tumble, don't get me wrong, Fundsmith and Finsbury Growth and Income are going down as well. You know, this stock market collapses, everything's going down, but it might not go down as badly and it might make a better return. There's a lot of mights there. There's a lot of could be's. There's a lot of speculating. But I suspect that in the long run, there's a possibility that Terry Smith and Nick Train might actually turn out to be right on some of the stuff that they're saying. And there is also a possibility that you could see, you know, certainly Nick Train's portfolio, all of a sudden you could see quite a few of those companies potentially suddenly rise by quite a lot and show a big bounce back. So for now, I am not ditching them because I'm thinking that potentially they might be set up for future gains, perhaps even this year. But there's a big, big perhaps here. And I cannot help but think that as I'm doing this, I'm indulging in yet more wrong-headed investment thinking.
Well, Simon, one to watch. We'll discuss this time next year. Sticking with investing, thank you for being patient, Helen. We're going to talk now about the cash ISA. I know that's not investing, but basically the government cut the cash ISA limit for under 65 in order to try and get us investing. Now, I'm not sure who actually thinks it's going to work, except perhaps the Chancellor and a few of her close advisers. But now even MBs on the Treasury Select Committee say they remain to be convinced the reforms will drive the cultural change that ministers want to see. So, Helen, we've talked a lot about U-turns, haven't we? Will we get another one on this one? Recap on the cash ISA limit changes, if you would, briefly.
Sure. So This was one of the biggest personal finance changes that came in the budget at the end of last year. So Rachel Reeves said that the cash ISA allowance, which at the minute is £20,000 a year for everyone they can save tax-free, will be cut to £12,000 a year from April 2027. But, and this is a caveat that I think a lot of people find quite strange, only for under 65s. So if you're over 65, you can carry on saving 20 grand a year. Under 65s, it's going to be cut to £12,000 a year. You will still have, this is where it gets a bit confusing, you will still have a £20,000 a year ISA allowance. However, only 12 can be in cash and the rest, the other £8,000, can go into stocks and shares. So the idea is to encourage people to invest more of their money. And the reason Rachel Reeves wants to do this is to give the give a bit of a boost to UK companies and the UK economy. So, you know, we're seeing obviously sluggish growth, businesses aren't really investing, and she wants more people to sort of pour cash into UK companies, UK listed companies, so that they can invest in their businesses, you know, grow, hire more staff, and hopefully she hopes it will create a sort of a virtuous circle within the economy. It could have been worse, it's worth saying. So before the budget, people were talking about the cash ISA allowance being cut to as low as sort of £4,000 a year, which I think would have been really sort of disastrous for people's savings, because the cash ISA is obviously such a popular product. And it's one of the few financial products that you know, the normal person on the street really does understand. You know, they're incredibly popular. I think about 40% of the money held in ISAs is in cash ISAs, which might not sound like a lot, but I think that's because people who hold money in stocks and shares, it tends to grow more quickly over a longer period. So their pots maybe sort of balloon more quickly, but cash ISAs is still incredibly popular. So what the Treasury Committee has said, they're basically a committee of MPs who sort of run the rule over Treasury decisions, all the stuff that Rachel Reeves is planning, and whether it's going to work, whether it's sort of fiscally responsible. They met this week, and Meg Hillier, who's the chair of that committee, basically said she doesn't think this drive to get people to invest is going to work, which is quite damning. She's essentially said reducing the allowance and the publicity which would have to go alongside such a reduction is unlikely to increase the level of saving in shares in the UK. So, yeah, very, very bad, bad sort of week for Rachel Reeves. Plan not going to work at all, these MPs are saying.
I take back what I said earlier. Obviously, investment companies are probably a big fan of this, because if it does possibly mean that more money goes into investing, they've got nothing to lose. But even then, lots of them haven't agreed with it. So it can't have come as a big surprise to the Chancellor. However, I am dubious we'll get any change here. There's just, I mean, to have another policy U-turn, I think, would just be one disastrous step too far. So I think we are where we are with it. But Simon, what's your view?
I mean, my view is that I've had conversations about this with some of the senior people at some of Britain's biggest investment platforms, including the chief executive of the second biggest one, Interactive Investor, right? And they have all said that this is a bad idea. II is an interesting example because it's got no skin in the game. II doesn't offer a cash ISA, right? So you could see why, for example, so our friends are trading 212, also bad idea. I mean, this is a platform signing up huge amounts of investors, right? They also offer a cash ISA. They've said, terrible idea, right? They've said it won't get more people investing. And actually, it just sort of undermines, you know, the ISA system. And they said, don't do it, right? But they've got both products. So at least, you know, they've got a bit of skin in the game. They don't want their cash ISA undermined. But I mean, Richard Wilson at II, they don't have a cash ISA. He was like, no, it's a terrible idea. So the government, we told the government this. The government didn't listen. That's basically what the general thing from the investment platform and investment industry has been. As we told the government this was a bad idea, they didn't listen. There are some in the investment industry who've been pushing for this. Largely, it comes more from the kind of fund management side, right? Who they do, you know, they will benefit. But also there's this suggestion that even if more people did invest off the back of this, right? So say you've got the limited number of people who could actually put more than £12,000 into an ISA and are currently filling up a cash one. Even if some of those people took that £8,000 and they invested it, it's probably not going to go into the UK stock market in meaningful amounts. A lot of it's going to go into global tracker funds, those things we were just talking about. And if it goes into them, 75% of it's going into US shares.
Yep.
The buying behavior that we see on the big investment platforms and then also in other places is not that the money is going to go into the UK stock market. I mean, if so, say someone's got a financial advisor or wealth manager, right? So they've got a professional helping them manage their money. And they say, right, okay, I was going to put my £20,000 in a cash ISA. I've now got eight left over because I can only put 12 in. So I'm going to invest that instead. That financial advisor or wealth manager is not going to tell that person to put £8,000 into the UK stock market. The starting point for that financial advisor or wealth manager is almost certainly going to be invest in line with the market. So 3/4 of it goes into the US. And then maybe if you think differently, you can move a bit away from that. But they're not going to suggest putting a large amount of it into the UK stock market. Now, in aggregate, it might mean a bit more money going to the UK stock market. But the counterpoint to that is you're undermining the country's most successful saving and investing scheme because people don't hear the nuance. They just hear ISAs being cut and they go, well, what's the point? They'll only change the rules again. What's the point? I put the money in my stocks and shares ISA. They'll only change the rules again. And so I think it was misguided and foolish. And I'm not surprised that this report has suggested that it's probably not going to do what the Chancellor thinks it's going to do.
That's it for part one.
I am joined now for our weekly Investing Explained feature by Blerim Gashi of Charles Stanley Direct. Blerim, we've got a question here from a listener. I want to build an investment portfolio and would like to hold individual shares in it. How many different shares do I need to diversify?
The first thing I like to do is give a bit of research and context, you know. Talking about diversification and individual shares, this goes back to kind of modern portfolio theory. And modern portfolio theory shows that you don't need hundreds of holdings. In fact, you know, the kind of nice number is around 20 to 30 shares. And that is essentially the amount you need to kind of essentially reduce company specific risk. Beyond that point, any additional shares tends to make a very, very small difference in overall volatility. But I will say, just because you have 20 to 30 shares doesn't mean that that diversification is kind of complete. There are other factors you need to think about as well as just as hitting a number. It's about variety, you know, mixing companies from different industries and sectors and, you know, exposure beyond just one region or market theme. Historically speaking and speaking to people in coaching calls, researching 20 to 30 companies can be a lot outside of, you know, working hours and kind of family life in general, which is why many people kind of do a core satellite approach where the core is essentially the funds, where the kind of diversification is already embedded into it. By choosing the stock selection and things like that. And then, you know, the 20 to 30 holdings is something that they feel like they are interested in and they'd like to fill any gaps if the stock or fund that they have is there.
Blerim, great advice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Homeowners in the capital are facing a rude awakening when they come to try and sell their homes as property values continue to plunge. Prices in parts of London are in freefall, with some people forced to cut their losses and sell for up to 50% below what they paid in some cases. Up until 2015, London's house prices were rising so quickly, it would have seemed impossible to lose money. But since then, house prices across swathes of the capital have barely moved, and now some say a full-blown crash appears to be taking place. Helen, as the Londoner here, what's going on?
Yeah, this hasn't made
me sorry, the London living person, proudly from the Midlands.
That is true.
That's
true. I worked out the other day that I've been in London for 15 years, so I think I count as a Londoner, just about, if they'll have me.
If you want to be, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm a bit on the fence, to be honest. I probably sound a little bit too Brummy, so
yeah, exactly. So what's going on in London, though?
Yes, it's not been good. So we've got this great piece which is really picking apart everything that's happening in the London housing market. Essentially, anyone who's bought in the last 10 years or so might have a bit of a rude awakening if they come to sell, and they might be selling their house or flat for less than they bought it for. So London had this huge little property boom between the sort of end of the financial crisis and about 2015. So that sort of period between the financial crisis and Brexit, essentially. The average home in the capital rose by 83%, according to land registry data, which is phenomenal in just 6 years. So going from an average of £263,000 to £482,000. But since then, prices across a lot of the capital have been really stagnant and are now starting to go down. It does depend, as always with house price data, it always depends on what type of property you have and the precise location of your property. Because, you know, not all parts of London are equal. There's parts that have seen and are still seeing huge sort of gentrification where people have made huge amounts of money. And, you know, even down to particular streets in a neighbourhood, some might be more attractive than others, might be doing better. You know, there's hundreds of these sort of micro factors. But in general, this data does show some really big price rises, even in the last couple of years. So looking at since the start of 2023, the average price of a flat in London has fallen by more than 7%. But in some of the higher end locations, so City of Westminster, which isn't just central London, you know, that includes sort of posh, I would say suburbs, posh sort of inner London suburbs like Marylebone, Maida Vale, St John's Wood, prices are down more than 27% since the start of 2023. Kensington and Chelsea, 20% fall. And I think flats are an interesting issue as well. That's something that's kind of happening across the whole of the country, but it really comes into focus in London because obviously so many homeowners do live in a flat. Flats have really been marred by leaseholders, all this controversy over leasehold and service charges, I think is really putting buyers off. And also the cladding scandal, which, you know, there are still homeowners stuck in properties with unsafe cladding. And I think even on flats that don't have any of those issues, there's a sort of psychological barrier. You know, potential buyers are thinking, oh, do I really want to buy a flat in a block? It just seems in general, there's a general sort of bad feeling about it. So as someone who owns a flat in London, I'm feeling absolutely great, to be honest. what could go wrong?
Give it time. Long-term investment and all that. If you do need to sell, though, are there any tips?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult at a time when things are generally sort of flatlining. I think it depends on when you bought it. You know, if you have a flat that you bought, say, or a home in London that you bought 15, 20 years ago, you're probably still going to see an increase. I think the general advice from agents is to, although it might be tempting to price it optimistically and, you know, really try and make sure you get your money back on it, actually sometimes being a bit more realistic with the pricing can work out better. You know, if you price it quite competitively compared to other houses in your area, you'll get more buyers in. You might even still be able to generate a bit of a bidding war, and eventually you'll get more offers. So I think the importance of actually getting people through the door and not putting them off with a price that people see as too high is a big one. And also just knowing what's on the market in your neighbourhood. So have a look at what's around, make sure you're sort of in line with those. You know, you've got to sort of think through the eyes of a buyer, I suppose. What else are they seeing? How does your place look compared to the other things that they're looking at, I suppose, would be the advice.
Simon?
Yes, it's really important to look at this London house prices thing and remember that what we're looking at here is not all London homes and all London flats. It's specific types of them. So new build flats are the ones that are hardest hit. You know, the whole market is suffering, but it's new build flats. And there's another thing that happened with new build flats that we have to remember, which is Help to Buy. Now, under the Help to Buy scheme, the government at the time, in their wisdom, Mr. George Osborne, came up with possibly one of the daftest schemes in economic terms ever, which was in order to tackle the problem of house prices being too high, he decided to lend people interest-free the money to buy the houses, up to 20% of their value. So basically, rather than making them cheaper, it just sort of filled the gap with some cheap money. Obviously, then that had to be paid back after the event. And what that did was it inflated flat prices rather than deflating flat prices. And it also encouraged building. So what we've got is there was a boom in new build flats that were being sold at inflated prices. And bearing in mind that new build properties are already sold at a premium because they're brand new and that's judged to be a good thing. You're the first person who's ever lived there. You will note that after you've bought it, that will never happen again. You will only ever be the first person to have ever lived there. The person you sell it to will not be the first person to have lived there, and therefore they may not be willing to pay the premium that you paid for being the first person to live there. Combine that with the oomph under it of the Help to Buy scheme, where we were lending people the deposits, and what you've got is a scenario where lots of people bought into flats at inflated prices, and the developers were able to flog them at inflated prices due to inflated demand. And that then combines with people being sold down the river on the stuff that Helen was talking about, leasehold, cladding, etc. So there is a whole chunk of people who bought new build flats, and certainly new build flats in London, who are certainly well within their rights to feel seriously aggrieved at how they got totally mugged off by the system.
All right, then. Now, you've probably noticed this. Perhaps if you've bought a train ticket online or maybe from your bank just for paying your monthly direct debits, cashback offers. They promise we can earn money while carrying out our everyday spending. Money for nothing. Great. While some are very lucrative, some say they can pay thousands in some cases, others are poor deals and could leave you out of pocket. So is cashback too good to be true? Simon, thinking back on podcast past, I'm thinking more of cashback sites here. Am I right in thinking you're not the biggest fan of this concept? But just explain, cashback, what is it?
I believe my statement might have been something along the lines of, life is too short for cashback.
I thought life is too short for loyalty cards.
Yeah, life is too short for loyalty points as well. Yeah. This might be a trope. There's a danger that I trot out the same old lines again and again. And
Simon Bingo.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Cashback. It's a way of getting some money back for something that you do. So you could use a cashback site to get some money back on your shopping. You could have a cashback deal from your bank account where when you spend money, you get some cash back. You could have it on your credit card as well. You could have it for moving some money to an investment platform. You can get it in lots of different ways. And if you're savvy and very, very smart about how you do it and you stick by the rules and you make the absolute most of it, it can prove to be very lucrative indeed. Although it should be noted that to make the most amount of money, you will need to start with a lot of money in the first place.
Like so many things, Helen, like so many things. Whenever I think of cashback, as I said, it's always these cashback sites. And I'm quite sensible with it. I only ever use it for things that I would buy. And I think I've made, I'm just checking here, £2,000 over 10 years. So it's not a massive amount, but it's something. So when I read your article that you could make thousands upon thousands, what is this?
Yeah, I think with these things, I'm a bit like Simon. I don't really do cashback. However, I do have friends that are really into it. And I think what you have to do is you have to fully commit to it. If you want to make any kind of worthwhile amount from it, you have to go all in. You have to make sure, you know, every debit card that you use has a decent rate of cashback on spending. You know, if you invest, your investment platform is giving you money for moving cash. You know, you use cashback sites like Jamie mentioned. I think you have to fully live the cashback lifestyle. So the way that you can make a lot of money is, as Simon said, having a lot of money in the first place. So one of the examples in our article is you could get £10,000 of cash back, but that's by moving an investment pot worth £1 million to a new platform. So, you know, yeah, exactly.
See what Simon means there.
It's those kind of numbers that will get you sort of thousands and thousands. However, I think, you know, the point of it is for people with a more normal budget, is sort of letting it add up over time, right? So say if you spend £1,500 a month and you've got a Chase account, so that pays 1% on essentially a lot of your normal spending, like groceries, petrol, train tickets, transport, and you can earn £15 a month if you spend £1,500. So that's, you know, that's an amount that a lot of people could feasibly spend on things like that in a month, you know, if you're a family. And I suppose if you do that every month, and then, you know, maybe you could be a bit smart and take all those £15 and put them in a higher interest savings account, you can invest them. And I think that's the way that, you know, you really start to make it work for you.
Is this an unqualified good? Because there's also suggestion that actually it could leave you out of pocket.
Well, yeah, because if you fall foul of some of these things, then you could end up losing money. So, for example, let's take a scenario where in order to get your cash back, you have to pay some money. Now, if you pay the money and then you don't make the most of it, you could end up paying more money than you get back in cash back. So if you book a train ticket at Trainline, for example, you might see a pop-up come up. It invites you to join a cashback scheme called Complete Savings. Now, this is an online membership scheme, but as Sam Bromley points out in our article, it costs £18 a month. In return, though, you get 10% cashback at more than 1,000 retailers. So the money builds up in your Complete Savings account, and you can withdraw to your bank after you've earned at least £5. You can get 10% cashback at retailers such as Anyvan, Clarins, Snow and Rock. But 10% cashback means you'd need to spend £180 a month to claw back the online monthly membership fee. Okay. Now, you might manage to get that fee waived if you make a qualifying purchase, claim But if you don't jump through all the hoops, if you don't meet all the terms and conditions, you will end up spending more money than you actually get back. And we talked about this last week. Any deal where someone is offering you something like cashback or points or reward points or Avios points or all these kind of things, you need to think, you know, why is someone offering me this? We were talking about the £750 cashback you could get for opening that HSBC bank account, right? Why did HSBC want to offer me £750 to open a bank account? Because it thinks it's going to make more than £750 off me. Why does someone want to offer me cashback on this? It's because it will get me to sign up, and they think that ultimately they'll make more money off of me. So play the game, hit all the rules, do exactly what you're meant to do, and you can win. But if you don't do that, then you won't. And I would use an example I've used many times on this podcast. Yours truly's unbelievably mind-bendingly stupid use of a BA Amex card in order to collect Avios points. I've had one for years. I've spent on it. And I'm terrible at forgetting to pay the balance off in full. And sometimes I don't do that. And so I do obviously pay the minimum payment. I'm not a complete klutz. Right. But I don't pay the balance off in full. Then I end up paying interest on, because I'm using it for lumpy spending. I might have like booked a holiday on it, or booked somewhere we're staying for a holiday, you know, putting like a grand on it or put some flights on it. And then you don't pay that. All of a sudden you get hit with the interest, and you incur interest charges that will massively outweigh any benefit you get from the flights, especially if you've never, ever managed to book a flight with the points. Which until very recently was me, but I have now managed to book a flight with the points. So at least I feel slightly better about the situation. So learn from my mistakes there and be careful what you sign up for.
I'm in a similar situation to you, Simon, except for the fact that I am fastidious in paying off my Amex. And for the first time after how many years? 2 years? I finally, it felt good. And you used a companion voucher as well.
So actually, you're not in a similar position to me. What you are is not actually using it properly. You're actually the direct opposite of me. You've saved it up until you could actually use the points to do something useful with it, and then you used a companion voucher in order to get the maximum value.
I've
paid a load of interest over the years, never booked a flight, and then the flight that I've booked is one single leg flight. No companion voucher, no nothing. I'm an idiot.
That's not good, is it? Mine was quite impressed at mine. I got a business return flight for two people for £600 to Toronto. That's not bad, is it?
That's really good.
There you go. So the only similarity there, Simon, was that, well, one, we had the card, and two, we've both recently spent the points for the first time. The rest is like, mine's a happier sort of ending story. Yours is less so. Anyway, we're going to move on. Finally, reader question. I feel like we haven't had a good reader question in a while. We've got in here. It's all about electric cars. I want to buy, not me, but if this was me, I would have a similar sentiment, because they don't want to buy a Tesla. I would be there too. And a used compact EV for under 10,000. I never buy new. Under 10,000 sounds about right. They also want a decent range. Who doesn't? So anyway, I need to be able to travel at least 200 miles between charges, and I have no brand affiliation, except what they don't want. So I'm open-minded about all other manufacturers. It too needs to be spacious enough for my husband, I wonder where that was going, who is taller than average, and often struggles with comfort in cars. But we also don't want a huge SUV, and that will struggle to park. Can you help? Sally from Essex. Simon, firstly, no Tesla.
No Tesla. No, I mean, you're ruling out one of the most popular, and also... By dint of being one of the most popular, one of the most available on the used market, electric cars. And the Tesla Model 3 is a very, very competent car. There are a lot of people, though, who have decided that due to Elon Musk's recent behavior and pronouncements and all those other things, that they will not be buying a Tesla. And there are people driving around with stickers on their car.
Stickers, I've seen those.
I bought this before he went mad, you know, apologizing for their car. So anyway, if you don't want to buy a Tesla, right, because the answer to this could just be go buy a used Model 3. They're actually incredibly good value and they're quite good cars, right? If you don't want to buy one and you want a cheap run around, what can you get? Now, Frida has driven a lot of electric cars in her time. She is a genuine motoring expert, Frida Lewis Stemple, our motoring reporter, and she's a genuine EV expert. And she has picked out a couple here. And also, we've got the price, what you could buy used. So basically, looking at a car that is between 3 and 5 years old and that fits the bill of what we were talking about, Volkswagen ID3, used price £9,500. Really popular, small electric car, has a claimed range of 260 miles. We found a 2020 car with 98,000 miles on the clock for $9,500. Battery is still just under warranty. This is a solid car. People really like these, and you're always going to probably benefit in terms of depreciation from having a car with a VW badge on the front. The Kia Soul, this is a more boxy car. It's been discontinued. It's probably not going to benefit in the same way in terms of holding its value as the VW, but Kias are very popular cars. Great range, 280 miles, £8,600 for one of these. Comes with a 7-year, 100,000-mile warranty plan and a separate 8-year, 100,000-mile warranty for the battery pack. As long as it still has at least 70% of its original capacity when you buy it. Watch out for this kind of stuff when you are buying used electric cars. Check out all this stuff. Read the buying guides and check the stuff carefully. Another Kia, the e-Niro, $6,500. Hyundai Kona, sister brand to Kia, that would be £10,000. And then the Vauxhall Corsa Electric, that would be £7,000. And finally, you could also opt for something like a Mini, but then you're going to be paying more money.
All right then, Simon. Your stats of the week.
30%. Mm-hmm. That is the amount that silver is up, almost 30%, I should say, this year already. It has more than tripled in value since the start of 2025, eclipsing the rise in the gold price, which was about, when this article was written, about 8% since the start of the year and 80% since the start of last year. So whilst there's been a lot of attention on gold, it's silver that has actually been going like the absolute clappers. You know, it's speculation, largely. Metals are, you know, rising quite substantially. And, you know, silver is chasing the gold price up. What I would say, if anybody is thinking of investing in silver off the back of this, is just be very careful, because what goes up very quickly can come down very quickly.
All right, then. That's it. Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your questions and tell us what you want to know. Also, come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate and read the comments. And you can find all podcasts past to listen through our back catalogue and find your greatest hits.
Awesome. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.